So today's talk, could you grab that clock? I don't want to stretch my microphone. Today's talk is on dealing with fear, anger, and hatred as a Buddhist. And I'm imagining you're all wondering, like, why would we be talking about that? seems kind of irrelevant, you know. So this is our own fear, anger, and hatred, and it's that of others. I'm going to present the Buddhist teachings on this. And they're not, I mean, obviously, there's so many Buddhist teachings. These aren't all the Buddhist teachings on them, but some of the core Buddhist teachings on this. And I'm beginning to get more respect for the importance of doing that. Now, I was at a pastoral care workshop this last week, which is caring for people within the framework of, you know, within a religious framework. And one of the things that was presented there was something the Christians call theological reflection, and I'll call Dharma reflection, which it meant you, as a practitioner, a person of faith, you steep yourself in the teachings. And, you know, it's many experience of many of you, I'm sure, that, like, there's so many teachings. I mean, you can't get your mind around all of them and have this sense, like, yeah. And yet, over time, you just kind of let them flow in, let them flow out, and we become kind of saturated with them. We become influenced by them. And then, what this Dharma reflection is here's the teachings, here's our lived experience, and then it's like the conversation between those two. The, like, what is that about? How does that apply? This is my experience. This is what the teaching says. Huh, that makes sense, or it doesn't make sense, and actually in the Jewish tradition, there's a big tradition of this, and actually Israel means wrestling with God. Mm-hmm. So you're supposed to, like, okay, these are the scriptures, these are the teachings. You're supposed to wrestle with them. So anyway, so I'm going to present the teachings, and then we can wrestle with them. And another reason for understanding the teachings is how important framing is, how we conceive of things and put language to them, and really, really affects how we relate to them. So let's start off with the nature of fear, anger, and hatred from a Buddhist point of view. So we start from the premise that all beings, no matter what, seek happiness and avoid pain. And this isn't a Buddhist teaching, it's just the most fundamental, it's like the fundamental definition of animate life. It moves away from something that seems painful and toward something that seems, you know, nourishing or rewarding or pleasant. So even amoebas do this, right? Even plants do it to some extent. But human beings are a lot more complicated than amoebas, and we tend to get confused about what actually leads to happiness versus suffering, and what happiness even really is. So that's the gist. We talked recently about the three poisons. So lobha, which can be translated as greed, craving, sensuality, or desire. Dvesha, which can be translated as ill will, aversion, hostility, or hatred. And moha, which is a state of belief in something false and can be translated as delusion, confusion, foolishness, or ignorance. So, you know, greed, ill will, and delusion. So, in the context of these three poisons, according to the Buddhist teachings, acting out of these three poisons inevitably leads to suffering. Not a good idea. Well, we'll talk more about that. Now, fear, anger, and hatred are all intimately related, and they're essentially different stages of that manifestation of ill will. So, in a sense, fear just kind of naturally arises. We're just beings, and we get scared sometimes, and fear arises. And anger actually kind of naturally and quickly arises in its purest form as well. It's a sense of needing to protect something, ourselves or something that we care about. So they arise. But the real question in terms of practice is then what do we do with them? So it starts with fear, then we get angry, and then we mix in some delusion about being separate from others, othering people somehow. You're fundamentally different than I am, and I override my natural compassion and empathy. And then it can all coalesce and develop into hostility and hatred and aversion and prejudice and all that. So unless we are practicing that, fear and anger can develop into this poison of ill will, aversion, hatred, hostility. So, you know, the fundamental question really is, if we have this nature to seek happiness and avoid pain, and most of us are equipped with empathy, then why do people end up causing so much suffering instead of happiness? Why is this? So, this isn't a classic Buddhist teaching to divide it up like this, but this reflects just a way that I've organized it in three main reasons. So there's three main reasons why we, of course, but people that we might observe who are doing things that we just can't get our minds around. Is this person just inhuman? Are they fundamentally evil? Do they lack empathy? How is this happening? So the three main reasons, from a Buddhist point of view. One, a disconnect between cause and result. So whenever the cause and the consequence are removed from one another in time and space, we just don't get it. Unless we do something and bam, you know, mm-hmm. suffering for myself or other arises immediately, or maybe a week later, we just don't get it. And we especially don't get, you know, kind of indirect causes that have caused suffering far away from us or in subtle ways. So this is why, you know, things like quitting smoking is so hard. The painful consequence is, you know, kind of vaguely related and far away. Or why many of us can continue to purchase items that we know are made in abysmal conditions halfway across the world. I mean, the intellectual knowledge that this action is causing suffering just isn't quite enough for us. Whereas if we were able to make that connection, if we were able to, you know, pick up the cigarette and like, bam, you know, experience the sensations of lung cancer and not being able to breathe, and if we were faced with, you know, I'm going to buy this product, well, you know, I know, and faced with the empathetic grief of seeing the conditions that this produced in, we would probably recoil from the action in horror. But we just don't work that way. So this is why the Buddha's first insight on his meditation seat, his first insight, it's kind of a supernatural story, but he says he was able to recollect his past lives. And not just one or two or three, but 100, 100,000, a million eons of past lives. And he was able to observe, did this, and then this happened. Did, you know, the karmic cause and effect. And then he was able to expand his view and view that for countless beings. And then he observed these karmic principles. And what he saw, the gist of what he saw, was that what happens to people is based largely on their own past actions and the intentions they held when they did those actions. As opposed to many of the theories at his time, was like what caste you're born into, what kind of esoteric rituals you have performed on your behalf. That, you know, those people were trying to figure out how do we end up in the situations we do. And so what he saw was the importance of that, our actions and our state of mind when doing those actions. And he saw, you do a negative action, you will reap the negative consequences. It just might take a while. So that was his teaching. So even if you don't believe in transmigration, you know, the gist of this is that, and we don't have to have that kind of insight. To me, this means wise people through the ages have made observations about what kind of actions lead to positive results and what kind of actions lead to negative results. These are their recommendations. These are their moral guidelines. Like, if we accept our human limitation that we don't make those connections very well between cause and effect, if they're removed from each other, then what we do is we adopt those ways of behaving, we adopt those moral guidelines, and then we see, does it lead us reliably toward happiness? Rather than, well, I'm gonna test it all for myself, even though I don't have the supernatural abilities the Buddha did. So the second main reason that we and other beings just continue causing so much suffering is confusion about what true happiness is. So we seek pleasure, status, fame, wealth, adventure, beauty, sexual attractiveness, popularity, whatever. You know, these things give us some kind of satisfaction or pleasure. We hold desperately to views that allow us some kind of sense of safety or righteousness and importance. And all of these things, as Buddhism teaches from the beginning, are unreliable. They come and go. They're in limited supply. We have to often defend them against others. And we lose all of them eventually, anyway. So the question then was, of the Buddha, was, you know, like, what is there besides this? What is there besides just trying to grasp as much conditional happiness as we can? And this is essentially the Buddhist message and the message of most great faith traditions, that there's something else. There's something much deeper and more important than all of these conditional sources of happiness. And so they were asked to let go of grasping after those conditional things, or at least seeing them as the most important thing, and tasting something deeper. And this is why, you know, Buddhist monks, fully ordained Buddhist monks from the beginning, have practiced without any of these things. So regardless of how many of these pleasures we have in our lives, there's this example of they can find peace and happiness and joy and fulfillment without being able to dress the way they want to, without eating more than once a day, without eating what they want to, only what ends up in their begging bowl, without having a home, without having a family, without having sexual relationships, without having, you know, any of the kind of pastimes and pleasures that we're used to and really are attached to. We really like them. But there's this reminder that the real true peace and happiness doesn't depend on those things. But we forget, and people forget. So we forget what really matters in our scramble for conditional sources of happiness, which leads to all the manner of things, cheating, stealing, exploitation, etc. Because we know that that true happiness and peace within ourselves is incompatible with those things. If we're really truly at peace, we would not do those things. And then the third, the idea that we can gain happiness at someone else's expense, that we are separate from other beings, that we're not in this together. And obviously, from the point of view of Buddhism, this is our fundamental ignorance, is thinking that, you know, we inherently exist in some kind of enduring, independent way. That there'll be a me, you know, regardless if all of you disappeared and my circumstances change, there'd be a me. So we have to look out for numero uno, enjoy whatever advantages we have, strive to obtain anything we think we need. This is a world of limited resources. We inevitably conflict with others. I mean, and if we're good and moral people, we try to minimize the harm that we do others. But sometimes we just have to, you know, protect ourselves. And if we're protecting our family and loved ones, all bets are off. That's totally okay. I mean, then we can indulge in the three poisons because, I don't know, we're justified in doing so. This is really tricky. I mean, it's integral to who we are as human beings that we want to look out for and protect our families. And yet, if we engage in the three poisons, if we act out of the three poisons, even on their behalf, we will cause suffering. So, that makes it pretty tricky. We see our life and welfare as separate from those of others, seek as much conditional happiness as we can, even if our actions directly or indirectly mean there's fewer opportunities for other people to do the same. We can think of it as a dog-eat-dog world, and if you end up white or rich or free or living in a peaceful nation, it's luck of the draw. And we don't owe anything to others. And add to this the other views. A limited ability to connect cause and effect when they're removed in time and space. Confusion about what true happiness is. And you have a perfect recipe for the greed, inequality, lack of compassion that we see manifested in the world at such a vast scale. And of course, Buddhism's main point, separateness is delusion. You're not who you think you are. So, even though we know the teachings, we still may be plagued with fear, resentment, anger, ill will, and hatred on our own behalf or on the behalf of others. And even if we're not, we're living in a world where a whole lot of other people are. So what do we do? Now, this is where we can wrestle, right? You don't have to just you can't just accept this if this doesn't fit with your experience. But what you're asked to wrestle with is that Buddhism is absolutely unequivocal, saying there is absolutely nothing to be gained by letting our basic emotions of fear and anger develop into the poison of dvesha. Ill will, hostility, hatred, aversion, etc. Absolute no excuse. Not on behalf of your family, not to save the world, not to save yourself. Absolutely not. So there's the teaching. And we wrestle with it, but I mean, we hope, honestly, that when we're hanging on to our resentment, anger, or hatred, when we're unwilling to try, at least, to let go of it, I think it's because we hope that by hanging on to it, we're somehow going to stop or chastise the subject of our ill will. I mean, if we give up our anger, our ill will, our hatred, then we're just giving carte blanche to this person or these people to do these terrible things. Like, somehow this is protecting us. This is doing some good. So I think we hang on to it for a kind we think is a good reason. We're not just hanging on to it, because it actually feels bad. It actually feels stressful and sad and tears us up inside, but we feel compelled to hang on to it because we don't want to accept what's happening or give permission to what's happening. But the Buddha said we're just plain wrong about this. So in probably the most quoted section of the Dhammapada, he says, "Hatred never ends through hatred. By non-hate alone does it end. This is an ancient truth. And we find it very hard to live by this. Even though we can see that when there's mutual hostility, the situation's intractable. Whether it's on an interpersonal level or the level of nations, you're going nowhere. And yet, in those circumstances that seem kind of rare and special, when somebody manages to respond with goodwill, the situation is often, and not infallibly, but the situation's often transformed. I mean, I'm just thinking, you know, we just watched an episode of Queer Eye.
Oh, I love Queer
Eye. Which is incredibly, it sounds really weird, but it's an incredibly sweet show.
Yeah.
Where these five gay guys go and do makeovers for straight guys. And these straight guys are like, they're kind of based in Georgia, so they're visiting a lot of these, like, they just visited a white cop, Trump supporter cop. And they descend into this guy's life and, you know, they tell him how to dress and they tell him how to eat and they redo his house and they, you know, all this kind of stuff. And like, the connections, I mean, it's deeply profound, actually. And so in this most recent one, one of the guys is black, and he ends up like driving in the car with this guy for a kind of a long drive. And this is all, you know, on camera, and they have this conversation about police violence and, you know, the black guy confesses, I was kind of worried about meeting you and spending time with you because, you know, I just have this aversion. And the, you know, the other guy said, well, it's, you know, I think that what those cops do is terrible. There's no excuse for that. And the black guy says, like, thank you for saying that. And then the cop says, like, but we're not all like that, and we try to do right. And then the black guy says, like, he acknowledges that, and the two of them, you just see their faces. And they say later on in the program, they talk about this and how it just impacted them hugely. So there, I feel like even though those situations seem kind of rare and special, and like, what are you gonna do? You're gonna like stop the evil in the world one conversation at a time, you know, but to me, it illustrates that principle that the Buddha is pointing to. Hatred does not cease by hatred, by non-hatred alone. So, honestly, I think we are skeptical about this approach to respond to hate with non-hate and set aside any ill will, no matter what we're dealing with, because frankly, it sounds unrealistic and potentially dangerous. I mean, it really goes against our like, but this is a misunderstanding about what this actually means. So I recently did talk about the Brahma Viharas: goodwill, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. So these attitudes counteract the three poisons. We're asked to cultivate these and let go of the three poisons. And we think goodwill and compassion means being nice and accommodating to all beings. Oh, well, you know, you want to do racist things and oppress others. Well, I wish for you to be happy. You know, like, and this is not the case at all. That is idiot compassion, I've heard it called. That's not the case at all. So our heart, and I'm not saying this is easy, but our heart can be full of genuine goodwill. And we can take decisive action to stop someone from harming others or themselves. And I mean, there's no parameters on what this action might be. We might have to kill someone. I mean, as the most extreme example. If I really thought it was a matter of my life and someone else's who's attacking me, I think I would kill them if I could. I mean, and would I be affected by that? Would that... Well, I had an excuse, so I'm not bummed out. No, it would be terrible, but if we're going to act with compassion for ourselves, compassion for those who are going to be injured, and compassion for the perpetrator, who we are stopping from doing something that they're going to reap the negative consequences of. So that is another kind of compassion. So compassion does not have to be nice. So according to the Buddhist teachings, we can hold an attitude of goodwill, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. I mean, not only can we, but it says we should hold those equally and fully for all beings, no matter what they're doing. No matter what they're doing, no matter what they've done. And that will actually put us in the best possible position to help living beings. So, in terms of how do we free ourselves from the three poisons, cultivate the Brahma Viharas, overcome those forms of ignorance, like the connections between causes and results, what real happiness is, seeking our own happiness at the expense of others. I mean, this is really what our whole practice is about. So we have specific practices for cultivating the Brahma Viharas, which I've talked about already. And our zazen, it's about loosening that sense of attachment to self. Mindfulness is about learning to see those unconditional sources of happiness in our life, and you know, the list goes on. This is kind of all what our whole practice is about. So just in terms of, in particular, just to turn this a little out away from our own fear, anger, and hatred, which, you know, okay, if you may or may not buy the complete goodwill, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity, unconditional is the best way, but you get to wrestle with those teachings. But what about that of others? What about out there in the world? So even if we're working on ourselves, we can't make these people practice. People are destroying our planet, exploiting the poor, consolidating all the wealth in the hands of a few, fomenting othering in the form of racism, nationalism, xenophobia of all kinds. You know, what good is Buddhism in this situation other than just trying to, like, could, you know, it'd be good if you all were Buddhist and were working on yourselves. So I think Buddhism helps us. We can't do any good unless our feet are planted in reality. So it helps us see how beings are seeking happiness. They're just ignorant of all the things that we just talked about in terms of causal connections, the, you know, connection between self and other, what true happiness is. So, now I think a small fraction of humankind has deficiencies one way or another, that they actually do lack empathy and a moral compass. And I think those people should be carefully watched and restrained from doing lots of harm and damage to others. But they should also be treated with compassion because they are handicapped. You know, that's... Okay, we're going to need to keep you from doing that, but there's not... We don't have to hate them. Now the rest of the people, which that's just a very small fraction, the rest of the people, no matter what they're doing, are a mix of good and bad, just like the rest of us. So they may be acting out the three poisons when they go to a white nationalist rally, and then they go home and they act out the Brahma Viharas with their own family and kids. It's a crazy human phenomenon, but it's possible. They're a mix of good and bad. So our first responsibility, as Buddhists, as I see it, is education. And a rarely, rarely explicitly Buddhist education. I mean, people are interested, Maybe we can teach some mindfulness and meditation or something. But we want to communicate our vision of a world ruled by the Brahma Viharas instead of the three poisons. We want to communicate our value, our sense of interdependence, our value on true happiness instead of conditional happiness, all these kinds of things. We may do this through activism, art, our jobs, the way we raise our children, the way we vote, the way we spend our money, or just through the way that we conduct ourselves. You know, just through that personal example can be really profound. And approaching change through education allows us, it's much easier to feel that goodwill and compassion toward those on the opposite side of an issue from us. Because it's not that this person is inherently sick or evil or cruel, it's that they don't understand. And how do we get our point across? I mean, then there's all kinds of Buddhist teachings on skillful means. How do we lead beings out of the way that they create suffering and toward happiness? So we start with their basic humanity and think, in the end, they will be happier for knowing what I have to teach them. And it can be utterly sincere, not conspiratorial or condescending. It made me think of, if you have Mormons come to your door, you know, you may or may not want to talk to them, but, you know, I don't think most of us blame them for just putting themselves out there and really sincerely wanting to share what they think is the good news, you know? It's like, no thanks, but... So maybe people will see us that way, but we have to offer what we think is the good news. Now, at times, it will also become our responsibility as Buddhists to stand up and demand something change now. And that's, I mean, sometimes it will take too long to convince everybody to get on board. If we waited for even just a majority of people to agree, we might still have segregated lunch counters in schools. I mean, sometimes you just gotta, you know, draw the line and let people catch up. So in a way, like all of these approaches, they don't dictate what actions we should and shouldn't take in the world. I mean, unfortunately, that's still up to us. And just one final note is that another way that Buddhism can help, and in a way, I guess this is about us again, but it can give us the strength and equanimity required to face what's going on without succumbing to despair. We cultivate that the deeper realizations of our tradition. So I'll leave it there. Any comments or questions?
So a comment. In terms of the education, change hearts and minds. I've never seen anything more powerful than a personal story. Mm-hmm. How are you personally affected by what's happening or the people you know? And I think that's why the Queer Eye gets to me too, because they speak from their own experiences. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, as you were saying that, thinking about the power of stories, the way we use them in the work that I do. The thing that tipped the tide about separating kids at the border was that audio tape that got leaked, where that child was essentially speaking for themselves through just crying pitifully. Mm. And I think that just really cut through people, because it wasn't academic anymore. Mm. It was personal. It felt like my child when my child cried. And I just that, to me, that's where I feel like I have to put energy, is, you know, thinking about personal stories and how to get those out there.
Three weeks ago, I got two phone calls. One from a man who took over a business project that I was working on to the point where it became his project and I got tossed aside. And there's a lot of hurt about that. And then another friend of mine who, in the course of just a normal phone conversation, said just about the most racist thing I've heard since high school. And for the last 3 weeks, I've been thinking about how do I reply to these two people. The first one is a self-acknowledged sociopath. He knows he is. He's been diagnosed as a sociopath. He just doesn't see anything wrong with it. And I emailed him yesterday and said, you know, I find all of our face-to-face transactions really unpleasant. I have no desire to participate any longer. If you have a question for me, send it in an email and I may or may not respond, period. You know, I just shut it off, just shut the door. And I haven't called my racist friend back yet. And I've been, you know, how do I do this? And the door that I'm looking at is, he loves my wife, who is not white. And he doesn't find it the remotest bit contradictory that he has these racist outbursts and he can love my wife. But other people who say these things in my wife's presence have the same impact as what he said. So I have this afternoon on my goals is to give him a call and talk about it. But you know, how do I do it? My first response to the first guy was just, you know, oh. And I've certainly thought about just ending the friendship with this other guy. That's just, it's too easy. It's too easy. He doesn't know. So it's on my plate.
And that's where, you know, we have all these wonderful teachings about skillful means, where it's a completely different orientation. When we're going to address something like that, whether it's interpersonal or at a larger scale, our first inclination is just to say what we think is right. You know, just, you're wrong, this is how it is. But if our purpose is to educate them, which I always twinge a little bit because that sounds kind of condescending, but you know, sometimes it just, if our purpose is to educate them, then we think, what's going to work? What approach is going to let them hear me? How much can I say at this point? How can I avoid triggering defensiveness? Can I put this in language that they'll understand? What? You know, that is a completely different orientation than just, I'm going to bludgeon you with my opinions. Which, how often does that work?
I just saw a Netflix, actually a comedy, on about all this. I don't know if anybody has heard of her, Hannah Gadsby. Hannah Gadsby. She's a Australian gay woman, and been a successful comedian for a long time.
Yeah.
You saw it?
I haven't seen it. I just heard about it.
I watched it twice straight through. I mean,
okay.
It's like she basically says, I can't be a comedian anymore because it's I'm humiliating myself, because she makes jokes about her life and, you know, confrontations she's had with straight guys, things like that. And she just, you know, makes it a joke, but she said, I'm not going to do that anymore. And she talks about telling story, her true story, telling the truth. And she said, I'll probably have a job now. You know, she is powerful. Mm-hmm. I just really recommend seeing that. And it's sort of, well, it does speak to this to me. Oh, the name of the show is Nanette.
Oh,
Hannah Gadsby, Nanette. Nanette.
So does anybody have the reaction like, nah, you can't just cultivate goodwill and compassion for so and so and so.
It's also compassion for yourself. You know, I think of anorexia, bulimia, suicide, cutting yourself. There's a lot of things where at some point you have to go, hey, you know, don't do, you know, I don't know how you get people to stop doing self, you know, addictions.
Harm, yeah.
So, because I'm slapping them upside the head, but that doesn't always work. Unless you can also have compassion for your own situation, it's hard to or cut yourself some slack. You know, maybe karmically you have to deal with something different than the person next to you. But just think, we all have different homework, and a lot of times you get pissed off because you go, well, why am I writing a term paper? She got a quiz. So that's where the whole comparing thing, you know, you can get hung up.
Yeah, I mean, it just definitely doesn't, it's not fruitful to just like, okay, now we have another ideal to measure ourselves to, and, you know, at least 5 times over the course of this next day, I'm going to get irritated and resentful and judgmental, and so I'm terrible. What, I don't know. You know, that's not what our practice is about. But it can shift how we hold and respond to our own fear, anger, hatred, as we recognize this is not something that I want to hold on to and justify. This is something that's arising, and, you know, compassion for ourselves, like, I have not yet found a way. And like, I don't know if it was last week or the week before, I was talking about the teachings on metta. You know, and there's these elaborate teachings by Buddhaghosa on how to cultivate metta for someone when it's really difficult. Which I think is just grand, because it's recognizing, you know, for hundreds of years, thousands of years, it can be really hard. You know, it's like, think of them like this. Think of how they might suffer. Think of how in a previous life they might have been your mom. Think of how much the hatred, you know, hurts you. Like, all of these ways to try to unravel some of that feeling. So it's hard. But there's a big difference between saying, I still feel a lot of resentment and anger toward this person that has hurt me. I have not been able to let that go. Maybe I'll find my way through it. That's a lot different than saying, I have this anger and resentment, it is justified, and I'm gonna think about it, and I'm gonna think about how I'm justified and dwell on it.
One thing that's helped me is what you said before, is only a very tiny fraction of the population sociopathic or psychopathic, and the rest of the people just have different views. So people that go and blow up buildings and stuff, like, they think they're doing the right thing. And it doesn't mean you're not going to be angry with them, but, I mean, we've all wanted to, like, do something violent at one time in our life, right? And so you can at least kind of, like, somewhat understand it, even if it's completely different than something you would ever do.
And I personally found that was an easier way to live, to think of that, to think of, look, it is very difficult for me to imagine how someone committing a violent rape is seeking happiness. Okay, but, you know, if you think of them as being caught up in this ignorant, desperate, caught up in the three poisons, I find that less scary than thinking of them as a black pit of unpredictable evil.
Yeah.
Because what do you do with that? I mean, then who can you trust, and how does life make any sense? It's just like, So in a way that, even as kind of incomprehensible as that is, I find it more accessible. And I think I've seen it borne out, you know, just over and over in so many situations. If you talk to somebody who's done something horrible and their relationship to it, you talk to people.
Don was saying, you have your stories, but mm-hmm. the other part is they have their story. If you can stop and listen to it, mm-hmm. it doesn't make what they did any better,
yeah.
but there may be something there.
Yeah.
They have to listen, as painful as it is. You have to listen to their story.
Or protect yourself and just walk away. Which sometimes that says more to that person.
Yeah.
Like with your friend, if he realizes that his views have jeopardized access to all these people,
Yeah, and I mean, sometimes just a very, very minor thing. I mean, I've done and said silly and unskillful things. You know, I went on a trip to India and I took lots of pictures and I had lots of stories and I came back and kind of did this kind of slideshow presentation to my friends and in-laws and my then sister-in-law, who I never got along with. I don't think she ever liked me. So it was hard for me to accept this feedback, but she pointed out that my presentation seemed vaguely racist to her. That I was kind of like, I was talking about the Indians and what they did, and there was a kind of spectator aspect to it, which is really hard to hear. But I had to kind of go, oh, you know? And I'm sure I did not acknowledge to her that her comment was fruitful. Sure, I did not, but it was.
So, wrestling with God and the Dhammapada, which I'm reading right now, and the verse about how hatred only ceases through non-hatred. And I hold that up against my personal experience. And my personal experience is largely colored by individual fights. But it's what I see when I look at the national stage right now. I see the world's biggest, dumbest schoolyard fight, which is never about violence, it's about hierarchy. It's about putting somebody else on the bottom so you don't have to be there. And the thing that I keep running into in my own experience is if there are five people in the room and four of them don't believe in hierarchy but one of them does, there's a hierarchy. That paradigm is sticky. That refusing to participate in it is not actually an option. And that's my personal experience, and so I run into this commandment, for lack of a better term, to non-hatred. But I don't want to be on the bottom.
I wonder about. I mean, it strikes me. I'm not saying that this would be easy, but it strikes me that there could be a playfulness about it. You know, when you're taking like a martial art class and, you know, we're gonna spar in order to learn more and one of us is gonna win. I mean, I'm gonna try to throw you. No hard feelings. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know. I mean, I've been able to avoid typical working environments all my life, so I've never had to really get in. I hate competitiveness. I hate competitiveness. Maybe because I'm so competitive, you know, it brings out a side in me that I don't like at all. So that's a wrestle. how to, when you have, you're right, you have, we have to engage in some of this, in just in the way that our world works.
Yeah.
And how do we do that without any ill will or hostility?
And yet knowing that simply to participate in this paradigm that has a binary output, winners and losers, simply to participate in it propagates it, right? If you refuse to be the winner, or if you refuse to be the loser, you don't have to want to be the winner, you just have to refuse to be the loser, then by the binary nature of the thing, somebody else has to be the loser, and it's effectively been propagated. It's just, it's bizarre because it gets put on you from the outside, and I don't see a way to say no to it. So that's me wrestling with God.
And let us know. Let us know. Give us a Dharma talk on it when you find a way through.
I don't have the answer to that, but I know, and I can be too competitive too, so I know that feeling. I don't have the answer because I don't know the specifics, but when I find myself in those situations, I look for ways to dismantle the whole thing. So that whole, and one way is to not participate, because it gives other people permission not to participate. That's all I can think of.
I think it's the attachment to the outcome.
Yeah,
you know, so you're saying there's a winner and a loser. So in your mind, it's got to be one or the other.
Yeah.
Does it?
Yeah, exactly. Does it?
Yeah.
Well, if you're talking about who's going to keep their job, or
right,
who's going to have this opportunity, or, you know, I mean, there's like real, when there's real consequences involved.
Absolutely.
Just as an example, I got laid off towards the end of my work career, well, job, whatever. And some people would say that's a bad thing. Turned out it was a great thing. You know, Dr. Tucker has never been better. So it's a matter of your perspective and who wins and loses. Did I lose? I lost my job? But I won.
Yeah.
So.
Right. But it's difficult if you know you're going to cause suffering for somebody.
Yeah.
Because you don't know that they're going to have a nice attitude about it. I mean,
yeah,
it may make them, you know, whether that's legit or not, they might make feel miserable and sad.
My worst job experience was to fire somebody.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't think it was that bad for him. Tore me apart. It was like, oh. You know, fuck this guy over. And I really don't think he was that affected.
Well, I'm sorry I've let this go so long, and yet I'm not sorry, because it was a really good conversation. So thank you all.
Thank you.